local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.
And we're now going to start winding the clock back to 1968 and the first Apollo mission. And we'll start out by getting us into the mood by playing the Lost in Space theme by Apollo 440. That's the name of the group. And it's the theme to the television series, which, by the way, ran from 1965 September until 1968 March in the United States. Of course, it's had many reruns since then. So here we go with the Lost in Space theme. On the Space Show, we're back in the 1960s, and that was the Lost in Space theme by the group Apollo 440. Well, the Apollo's never got up to 440, and indeed, it is this week, 45 years ago, that the first manned Apollo was put into Earth orbit. Now, you might think this might have been Apollo 1, but no. Apollo 1 through to Apollo 7 were unmanned missions as tests of the spacecraft and the lunar module. And the first actual manned mission was Apollo 7. And this was launched in 1968, October the 11th, by a Saturn 1B rocket. Now, that's not the big 111-meter tall Saturn V rocket that sent people to the moon. It's a smaller, earlier Saturn vehicle. Now, Apollo 7 made 163 orbits of the Earth in 260 hours, proving that the spacecraft was able to last, first of all, to allow people to survive in it, three astronauts, and also to prove that it could go the duration of a lunar mission. So that was Apollo 7 launched in 1968, October the 11th, 45 years ago. Now, the crew of that spacecraft were Walter Schirra, who was a former astronaut from the Mercury days. He also flew Gemini. And then Don Ezzelli making his first space flight, and Walter Cunningham also making his first space flight. Now, notable features of the mission were that it was the first American live television broadcast from space. The Russians had done it earlier. And after being launched into space, the Apollo 7's craft, the command and service module, was undocked from the Saturn 4B upper stage and moved away, turned around, and then flew alongside it for quite some time, taking some absolutely astonishing photographs. Even today, they look quite wonderful. In a test of the technique that would be needed during a flight to the moon, in which they would approach the Saturn upper stage and dock with the lunar module and then extract it from that upper stage. Well, this flight had no lunar module, but they did test the technique of approaching it and seeing that was a possible thing to do. Now, on tonight's space show, we're going to hear from two of the astronauts who are aboard that mission. First, Wally Schirra, and later, Walter Cunningham. Now, Wally Schirra was interviewed by Roy Neal in San Diego, California, on 1968, December the 1st. And here's a little part of the conversation with Wally Schirra, the former Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronaut.
How would you describe the guys one by one? Just a thumbnail, you know.
Scott, I'm best described as being the proponent for the song Yellowbird. Scott loved music. We got tired of hearing Yellowbird. But Scott was more of the dreamer than the high technician, hard-nosed chess pilot, fighter pilot. Very competent, by the way, but didn't portray the role of this hotshot flyboy. Gordo portrayed the role of the hotshot flyboy. He, a sharp guy, a couple of times was looked down on by Deke because he wasn't a test pilot in flight test as Deke was. Gordo was involved with engineering test. Then we got to John Glenn, who made it quite clear what he was. He was a Marine, and the Marines are different. And we got along with John because he's a really a neat guy. We became very close. And John took over some areas that we needed to take a look at and worked on very hard. Worked on the flight control system as well as the Deke. Deke always complained about not having rudder pedals. He wanted rudder pedals. We couldn't have them, so we put yaw on the stick. So we got done with Gus Grissom, right, is probably the one that really hasn't been portrayed very well. Gus, little guy, sharp mind.
Let's wait till that jet goes by and save it for dear old Gus. That's an important number in the book. Okay, Gus.
Gus was an intent person, very intense. And his intent was to get things done right. Although Gus could be a lot of fun. We played gotchas on each other all the time. Tricks, of course. I guess my favorite Gus one, it was later when we were trying to do a Gemini vehicle, and we call it the Gusmobile. That's kind of where Gus was. He asserted himself and was so intent that it was obvious it was going to be his vehicle. And we called Gemini the Gusmobile. He was trying to fly a vehicle that would come down in a little parachute like a hang glider and almost didn't live through. He said, we're not going to do that. We all said, in that case, we're not going to do that. Anybody else have another opinion? Nope, that's our opinion. That's what Gus was like. Deke and Gus were very close. Both Air Force and both had gone through the same hoops together, I suppose. Gus had had combat in Korea. And I guess those who have had combat look at the others with a little bit less, not reserve, but less heroic worship, I suppose. John Glenn had combat. Deke had combat. I had combat. Al Scott, and who's left? Deke Slayton had no combat time.
And so, you've forgotten one person in your descriptions.
Oh?
Walter Marty Sherratt.
I said I had combat.
Yeah, you had combat, yeah. But you didn't describe yourself. How would you describe yourself, Wally?
I would say I was a truly committed flyboy, a test pilot. I'd had combat experience. I'd gone to China Lake, where I developed a weapons sidewinder, which is in production today, and this was done in 50, 51. I came from a flying family. I was very intent about it. One of the things I learned at the Naval Academy was the word commitment. I had made a commitment to be a naval officer, and I aspired to having command. And I felt very sad that when I left my Navy career, I was about ready to go to a squadron to be exec or skipper, my first command. I never had a command. And I regret that. I still do regret it. And that's why they teased me about my Apollo. You'll be commanding that flight, at least. I even got something from the Navy Department, because they heard about it. When Apollo landed in the ocean, it went down about maybe 4 or 5 feet and then bobbed back up the surface again. So I got a deep draft command thing that you were presented by the Navy Department. That was my only deep draft command. So even the Navy knew I was aspiring for command. But I suspect I was hard over. I really wanted this thing to work right. I was known as Jolly Wally for a long time until I got mad at Apollo. And then once in a while I get kind of tight. But why did I get mad? I lost my next door neighbor, Gus Grissom, who was killed in the launch pad. And I didn't feel very good about that. And I wanted things to go properly. I didn't want to make any abrupt changes. So that kind of attitude was always in me, but it never surfaced. I didn't need to have it happen. I had a good time in Mercury. I had a good time in Gemini doing that rendezvous. That was a ball.
Let's get back to that, though, because right now you're into a rather critical element of your career.
Mm.
That was the Apollo 7 mission. And so let's dive in there first, and then we can come back to Gemini, shall we?
Sure. Well, what happened with Apollo was an amazing series of events that happened. Initially, Gus Grissom and his crew had the first Apollo flight, Block 1. My crew, Cunningham and Isaac, had the second flight. I saw this as a very dumb flight, and I campaigned to have that flight canceled. There were a lot of scientific experiments, and I said, we're trying to get to the moon before this decade is out. If you remember what Mr. Kennedy told us, let's get on with that. We wasted a lot of time flying Grissom on a second flight on Redstone. We were about to fly a third one, and John got his orbital flight instead because we picked up momentum. I said, why should we duplicate two Block 1 flights, neither of which prove a thing about Block 2 and the capability of going to the moon and back? I will say moon and back. So I asked myself out of that mission. I think I'd have the first Block 2 mission. Suddenly, I'm now backup to Gus. I said, wow, I just lost a command role. And that kind of bothered me no end because I'd been backup to Scott, I'd been backup to Gus. This was going on and on and on. I said, I'm a little tired of being a backup. But as it was, I took that role on, not with the guarantee of having another chance at an Apollo mission, by the way. I was kind of chapped about that. We were saying, well, we are Mercury astronauts. You are a Mercury astronaut. You might have a Gemini. But Apollo, that's really the next team. I said, oh, that's interesting. You want me to be a backup with nothing to look forward to? No deal. Oh, well, no, I'm sorry. We'll back that off. This is Deke and Al talking that way, the other two smart S's. I went along with this for a while. But then when we lost Gus on the pad, suddenly I have the first Block 2 flight. And I realized, this is not very nice. I'm taking over a mission that my buddy was not able to fly. That was a tough one. So with that, we went through a lot of trauma. NASA, unfortunately, as a bunch of civilians, didn't know how to take off the black armband. And military people moan inside, cry inside, bleed inside about losing a compatriot. But they wear the black armband to the funeral, and that's it. It's gone. NASA wore the black armband for a year. And we kept saying, look, take the band off. We've got to get back to work. Gus would be the first person to say, let's get on with it. Do good work. And that was the kind of attitude I had going into Apollo. I was annoyed at the way what became Apollo 1 came out of the plant at Downey. It was not finished. It was what they call a lot of uncompleted work or incomplete tests and work done on it. So it was shipped to the Cape with a bunch of spare parts and things to finish it out. And that, of course, caused this whole atmosphere of developing where I would almost call it a first case of bad go fever. Go fever meaning we've got to keep going, got to keep going, got to keep going. When my crew did the test that was followed by Gus and his guys, we were in sea level atmosphere, no pure oxygen. We were in shirt sleeves. And there were things going on I didn't like at all. I was no longer annoyed. I was really pretty goddamn mad. There were glitches, electronic things that just didn't come out right. That evening, I debriefed with Joe Shea and Gus. I said, if there are any things that go wrong, like a glitch in the electronic circuit, some bad sounds, scrub. Because Gus and his guys were going to do it in pure oxygen in an environment that's not very forgiving. We didn't realize how unforgiving it was at that point. We'd gone through the same environment with Mercury and Gemini and made it through. Not that I think of it in that way, but that's how I look at it in retrospect. Gus, I can recall saying, if I can't talk to the blockhouse, how the hell are we going to go to the moon with this damn thing? That's how bad the communications were. He should have scrubbed. He didn't. He was himself involved in go fever. With that thought in mind, when I picked up the Block 2 spacecraft, I said, all of these things will be completed in the plant in Downey before it leaves the plant. I might add, today, even though we're doing an interview at some X point in time, I talked to Fred Peters, our NASA engineer, just today about Fisher Penn, trying to make a memento of the Apollo 7 on the Fisher Penn, and a turtle, by the way. Just today, Fred Peters. I talked to John Healy and Fred Peters every October between October 11 and October 22nd. And they both say, thank you, Wally, for a good mission. And yet, I wanted it to be a perfect mission. When we left Downey, John Healy and Fred Peters were the last guy in it, and they did a tumbling exercise. Take the spacecraft on multi-axis and whip it around, take all the spare things loose if it falls out, and they take them out and put them away. In orbit, I found a washer and a little nut, a little tiny bolt, and I presented each one of those guys one of these pieces, which I didn't find. But that friendship developed from the sense of perfection, because I had been annoyed. I said, I'm not going to mess around with an incomplete vehicle. When we got it to the Cape, Healy and I were there, and I'll never forget, it's Buzz Sebastian Hello. Said, well, nice of you to be here, fellas. I'm glad you're here. I said, don't you touch a damn thing. This thing is perfect. It's going to stay that way. Whoa. That's the same time he said, is there anything else you need? Because now he's getting a little, wonder if this guy's really real. And I said, no, I'm serious. We lost a crew on the launch pad. I want Gunter Vent, the pad leader that I had for Mercury and Gemini, to be hired by North American Rockwell and be our pad leader. I can pick this up easily. Buzz Hello said, I'll get you a Barbie doll if you want. I said, you don't understand what I'm saying. I want a guy up there so hard-nosed, I want a pad Fuhrer up there. And we'll not have go fever. We'll have nothing going wrong. We'll still do checks for dust and play games with each other. But I want a pro. And we had Gunter Vent for every Apollo flight. And guess what? They all worked perfectly.
Matter of fact, Gunter stayed with North American for quite a long time.
Yes. The fun of it was, and I might as well put this on camera. The last thing that happens when you mount up an Apollo, the clean room is ready to draw back, and the last person you can see, and only one person can see, and that's Don Eisley, the only window that has an opening, through the hatch looking back at the clean room, looks back and says, I wonder if I'm going to vent. And I've got to admit, he said that. I've stolen it, and I'll use it every time I can.
It made an event.
On the special show this evening on 88.3 Southern FM, we're listening to Wally Schirra, who 45 years ago at this very moment was in command of the first manned Apollo spacecraft, Apollo 7, in low Earth orbit. Let's go back to our interview with Roy Neal. This interview was recorded in 1998, December.
During the mission, of course, you had the misfortune of also catching a cold, so did the rest of your team. Did that influence the flight?
The cold did. It made us a little short, but I was short before we took off. In a meeting at Downey, walked into an open door meeting, dark room. They were discussing the couches that we would fly in this Block 2 spacecraft that were going to be Block 1 couches. And I said, oh, what does that mean? They all said, hi, Wally. Well, we can't get Block 2 couches ready in time. I said, what's the difference? Well, the Block 1 really can't take a land landing. Oh? Have a new mission rule then, don't we? What's that? We don't launch if the wind's going to blow us back over the beach. I guess that's a good mission rule. Guess what? We launched, and the wind was going to blow us back over the beach. So someone broke that rule. I didn't. I was compromised. Again, it was a case of a little go fever, not as bad as the real bad cases of go fever. But it was enough to make me annoyed, and that's bad form. Then in orbit, we launched on a Friday. I remember this very specifically. In orbit, our so-called Friday night, Don Eisley's on watch, and Cunningham and I are supposed to be sleeping. And I hear Don saying, Wally won't like that. What was that? Turn on my mic and listen in. Oh, I'm supposed to put on the television tomorrow morning. Well, we didn't have that in the schedule, gentlemen. That doesn't go on until Sunday morning. I should have said, I don't want to interrupt Howdy Doody. That would have gotten away with it. But I really was saying, we have not checked this system out. It's in the flight plan to be checked at this point in time. We'll check it at that point in time. We did. We did the Wally Walton Don show Sunday. But by then, everybody said, these guys are getting testy up there. They're not mutinied, but they're not going along with the flight controllers. I have yet to meet a flight controller that ever died falling out of a chair like this. That was my whole attitude from then on. Don't mess with me, guys. This is my command, and I wasn't kidding. And I'll take all the advice, all the information you can give me, but don't push us around. We're still worried about whether this is a safe spacecraft or not. And we had even got to a point where they're going to shave all our hair off in case it was a fire. Now, why am I going to start running a TV show for somebody if I haven't checked the camera out? All electrical circuits, piece by piece. Aha, it works. Now I'll show you TV. Oddly enough, we got an Emmy for that Wally Walton Don show. So I can't really say it was a bad deal.
Coming as it did, too, on the heels of the disaster, this was a tremendously important flight from a NASA point of view. It really had to be.
It had to be perfect. That was. I was so thrilled because I was at the Cape recently and I saw Sam Phillips drive. Sam Phillips, then a general, called that mission 101%, which was Spacecraft 101, by the way. Yeah. But that thrilled me no end that Sam saw that what I was trying to do was to make it at least 101%.
The crew that you flew with, did you pick them?
No, I did not pick my crew. Don and Walt were assigned by Deke. Don was easy to work with. Walt was very difficult to work with. My wife said, and Walt's heard me say this, so it's not out of school, he's like a puppy dog. Scratch him behind the ears and do anything you want. When I stopped scratching him behind the ears, it was real hell.
Well, after the flight of Apollo 7, did you think that your career would continue within NASA?
Oh, no. Prior to the flight of Apollo 7, a lot of people don't remember that, I announced I was retiring, leaving NASA, and possibly retiring from the Navy prior to the flight. So I had that in my little data bank. I hadn't really committed to retiring from the Navy yet, but I was definitely leaving NASA.
There was another world out there waiting for you.
Well, I also knew, having almost not had an Apollo flight at all, if you go back to that point in time, there was no way of going to get another Apollo flight. And it turned out no crew commander was to get a second Apollo flight. And the only one that broke that rule was Tom Stafford on Apollo Soyuz. Now, others had flown twice in Apollo, but not as a commander. So I knew that my destiny was there. I was gone. And I knew the space station, Skylab, would take too long for me to get involved. We had to go through all the lunar landings, all of that. And I'd seen these transitions from Mercury to Gemini, Gemini to Apollo. Those are long, hard, dry spells. I had no idea how long shuttle would take, although it had been talked about.
That was Wally Schirra. And as you heard there, he flew Mercury, Gemini, and 45 years ago, this very moment, he was in space in command of the first manned Apollo, Apollo 7. Now, one of the other astronauts that was aboard Apollo 7 was Walter Cunningham, making his first, and as it turned out, only space flight. Now, after he returned to Earth, he was asked to do the public relations thing and go on tour. And he got the lucky straw of coming to Australia and New Zealand. And in this clip, we are going to hear his account of his visit to Australia and New Zealand following his Apollo 7 mission in 1968.
Early in the Apollo program, it became standard practice after each mission for the flight crew to take off on a grand tour covering key cities in the U.S. and abroad. The obvious aim of these dog and pony shows was to spread goodwill for the space effort and for the United States. In NASA's efforts to squeeze the maximum value from these excursions, their imagination was limited only by the degree of cooperation they could expect from each flight crew. To a degree, the flight crew could influence the scope of these post-flight activities, and they were in a fine position to bargain. They might show a little more enthusiasm for NASA's desires in return for the approval of an appearance or a speech that could help a friend or a business contact. The real prize in the post-flight reward league was the grand tour. These were not just sun and fun-filled vacations out of some travel folder. Most of the days were long and tedious and filled with official functions. but I never heard of a crewman or a crewman's family who wasn't anxious to make one. How elaborate a tour was laid on depended on NASA policy at the time, the national and international interest generated by the flight, and just plain timing. Certainly, the Apollo 11 crew, the first lunar expedition, was in more demand than any group or individual since Charles Lindbergh. Their tour represented a masterful job of planning by NASA and the State Department. Phileas T. Fogg would have wept with envy, and I suspect Buzz Aldrin wasn't as reluctant a passenger as he made out. The tour is described ad nauseum in Buzz's book, but it can be summarized as 23 countries in 45 days, with a footnote for what Joan Aldrin described as 3 kings in 2 days. That was heavy company, and the schedule was hectic. But other crews, notably Apollo 13, whose narrow escape from misadventure captivated the public, endured schedules equally as daunting. The Apollo 11 crew did carry the brunt in 1969, but in the years immediately following, the number of flights was cut in half, while astronaut appearances nearly doubled. It was briefly a mystery to Don and me why the flight of Apollo 7 inspired so little post-flight activity after such tremendous pre-flight interest. The exchanges between Wally and Mission Control had turned off more than a few people, but I also knew that NASA had to keep the bandwagon rolling. Requests for the crew were being fielded, as usual, by the Public Affairs Office at NASA headquarters. As rookies, Don Isley and I were not too proud to venture out among the natives to receive a little homage. Maybe a little parade, or something. Wally, on the other hand, after 3 missions, had ridden in enough parades to last him a lifetime. Anything short of a New York ticker tape parade with the Radio City Rockettes in his lap would probably not have been acceptable. The one parade being pushed by NASA was in San Francisco, California, which happened to be my home state. Without our knowing it, Wally had left orders at NASA headquarters that all post-flight activities were to be channeled through him. When the pitch was made for the San Francisco parade, Wally quickly vetoed it. Poor cooperation wasn't going to improve a reputation earned in flight as NASA's tarnished heroes, and we eventually coasted through one of the least demanding post-flight calendars of any Apollo crew. The closest Lo and I came to a grand tour was a 10-day swing through Australia and New Zealand in May of 1969. As a kind of mini-junket, it was representative of the treatment astronauts received abroad, and the itinerary was a challenge. It was among the more memorable experiences of our 8 years in the space business. The occasion was the annual celebration of the victory of the Battle of Coral Sea, in which American and Australian forces fought side by side in a naval engagement that became a turning point in the Pacific War. The battle began May 4, 1942, and ended 4 days later, and saved Australia from invasion by a Japanese armada. We were there in a unique diplomatic social role. It had been traditional for high-ranking military officers to represent the United States at the anniversary celebrations that took place throughout the Australian continent. The year 1969 found tensions rising over certain political issues, including the war in Vietnam. And in an effort to play down the anti-Japanese implications of previous ceremonies, the Australian government had indicated that a civilian representative would be preferred. An astronaut was a likely candidate, which is where I came in. Other departures from the past promised to make the trip a trying one. In prior years, the dignitary of the moment, an admiral or four-star general, would tour the 7 largest Australian cities over a period of 3 weeks, reinforced by vessels of the Pacific Fleet or the Air Force Band with appropriate regalia. In 1969, it was compressed to 5 cities in 7 days. There would be no Pacific Fleet or Air Force Band, but only what we could muster in the way of support from the U.S. Embassy. In effect, it would be a cappella. Then, too, there would be a number of school appearances, added in deference to the intense interest of youngsters in space exploration. And finally, we would be traveling without the usual entourage of protocol people. Throughout our visit down under, we traveled in style in the personal jet of Prime Minister John Gorton. His BAC-111 became the flying command post for our entourage, which varied between 6 and 12 people. The significance of my role was brought home when the captain of the aircraft requested my permission in Melbourne to carry the Minister of Supply, the equivalent of a cabinet post, with us to Canberra, our next stop. Wherever we went, the schedule was laid out with stopwatch precision. The first stop, Brisbane, offered a typical agenda. Tea and biscuits with city officials and officials of the Australian American Association. A press conference, a parade, the laying of a wreath to honor the dead of World War II, a luncheon with speech and receiving line, a visit to the local racetrack for 2 races and an introduction, an appearance at a rugby match with a parade around the field at halftime, a presentation to a combined assembly of local high school students and talk show audience, back to the hotel to tidy up and dress for a black tie dinner dance and speech, then to bed around midnight, to be up the next morning to start all over again in another city. In Sydney, I was able to sneak away, with 2 detectives in tow, for 20 minutes to buy a sweater. It was cold down there in May. That day was topped off with 2 formal dinners. I mean real formal, cutaways and tails. The second followed on the heels of the first, and neither sponsor was supposed to know about the other. The Australian people are open and friendly, very much like those in the American Southwest. Most of them felt a strong identification with the American people and the space program. The first person to greet us on arrival in Brisbane was the Right Honorable Lord Mayor, Alderman Clem Jones. His first words to me were, "So you went to UCLA. Well, I graduated from there myself." That proved to be typical of the Aussies in their attitudes towards Americans. I encountered nothing but friendliness, even though the Australian government at the time was embroiled in problems concerning the use of U.S. Air Force tracking sites in the interior and a controversy over the purchase of American fighter planes. I finally did get my very own Heroes Parade through downtown Adelaide, and it isn't one I'll quickly forget. To begin with, Australians are a rather blasé folk, not given much to pomp or finery or frills. Their idea of a good time is to drink their share of beer and watch a little footy, Australian rules football. We were driven into town in an open Rolls Royce, which had been brought down under expressly for the transportation of Queen Elizabeth on one of her visits. As we approached the town center at midday, our instructions were to stand up and wave at the spectators. It was immediately obvious that the spectators could care less whether we were there or not. It was a Saturday, and they were clearly intent on their shopping chores. We drove through town, trying to attract attention by waving and smiling and otherwise looking silly while the good folks of Adelaide went blissfully about their business. Our Australian hosts must have felt that a touring astronaut was entitled to a parade. It was nice to be thought of as parade material, but the awakening was in finding out that we weren't. Parades, of course, are for the little kid in all of us. But at times, they can get hilarious. The Apollo 12 crew came back from their world tour telling about a parade they had in Iran, where the local Communist Party managed to put out some false information on the parade route. Pete Conrad, Al Bean, and Dick Gordon found themselves headed down the parade route while the crowds were lined up one block away, wondering where the astronauts were. In some of the countries they visited, many of the people don't read. They may know nothing of world events and haven't the foggiest idea of why those idiots are riding along in those great, huge cars. From Australia, we flew to New Zealand for 3 more days of celebrations and a civics lesson. New Zealand was probably the most socialistic country in the world and plagued by the frequent strikes that are characteristic of that form of government. There were several such industrial actions going on during our brief visit. The one that attracted my attention involved the pilots of Air New Zealand. The salaries of the captains on Qantas, the Australian airline, had recently been increased to $28,000 per year, while the Air New Zealand captains were making $12,000 a year to fly the same equipment over the same routes. They felt justified in striking for equal pay. At a luncheon our first day in New Zealand, I sat next to Prime Minister Keith Holyoake, to whom I had presented a New Zealand flag that I had traveled with on the 5-million-mile trip of Apollo 7. While making lunch talk, I happened to mention, tactlessly I suppose, how surprised I was to learn that captains on Air New Zealand earned only $12,000 a year. He replied, "That places them among the highest paid people in New Zealand." Then he went on to ask me, "How much do you get paid in a year, Mr. Cunningham?" That caught me off guard, but I answered, "Oh, $18,000 to $19,000. The Prime Minister then informed me that was about $6,000 more per year than he was paid. He received the equivalent of $12,500 a year in salary, with an additional household and entertainment allowance of about $6,000. The first family lived in their own home, run by his wife, with no outside help. He made his point. From his perspective, the airline pilots were asking for $5,000 more a year than the combined salary and allowances for the chief executive of the country. From New Zealand, we were headed to the Far East for a tour of military hospitals in the Philippines, Okinawa, and Japan. The Vietnam War was heating up, and our hospitals were just beginning to fill up with casualties. But first, we passed back through Sydney for our one day off in the month of May. It was here where I gained a little insight into the entire celebrity syndrome. There seems to be a kind of orbit in which celebrities move. When one has reached a certain level of notoriety, for whatever reason, he somehow becomes worth knowing. Total strangers know who you are, or think they do, and assume that a sort of fellowship exists among so-called public figures, that they all know each other, or would like to if they don't. We checked in at the Chevron Hotel in Sydney on Sunday night to find the lobby swarming with people. The manager explained, "Tom Jones is opening tonight in the lounge." I brightly asked, "Who's Tom Jones?" The name meant nothing to me. The first show was due to start in 30 minutes, and when someone asked if we would like to see it, we jumped at the chance. They were filling that room, 600 seats, three times a night, standing room only. Now someone had half an hour in which to find a table for six, front row, center. In the meantime, the manager insisted we meet Tom Jones, assuming, of course, that it was a courtesy to us both. While we were unpacking, Jones was brought from his room, past the throng of teeny bopper groupies camping in the hall of the penthouse floor, and to our door. I knew nothing about Tom Jones, and he had obviously never heard of Walter Cunningham. We shook hands and tried to make chit-chat. We really had nothing to say to each other. The one thing that passed between us, having any sincerity and meaning, was our mutual appreciation of the awkwardness of the ritual. We both knew that each had been dragged through that same routine many times before, and no doubt would be again. My sympathetic neutrality did turn quickly to admiration when he proved to be a superb showman. The eagerness of the hotel manager was a common affliction. The public is familiar with the attraction and popularity of an entertainer, and they tend to identify with that part of an astronaut's life as well, or think they can. With an entertainer, the public sees not only the personal acclaim, but its reason for being, the public performance. It's the same with an athlete, a Michael Jordan, or an A.J. Foyt, or a Pete Sampras. With an astronaut, it's not so simple. The acclaim may be the same, but the only direct exposure the public gets is the few hours in an astro's life when he is on stage during his mission. And even then, what he is doing isn't clear to most, let alone what he does with the other 99% of his time. The astronaut mystique more closely resembles that of a nationally known politician than that of an entertainment or sports figure. The ego trip provided by the worldwide attention lavished on astronauts returning from space can be intoxicating stuff. It's easy to get high on the flattery and the flourishes and self-satisfaction of a job that is unique. No one is totally immune. The trouble comes when one forgets that the acclaim is not so much for the individual as it is for the event, for the accomplishment. When the applause dies down, as it always does, the withdrawal symptoms begin.
And that was Walter Cunningham, who was one of those three astronauts who flew the first manned Apollo mission in 1968, beginning October 1968. And they landed on October the 22nd in the Atlantic Ocean. And the other person we heard in tonight's show there was Walter Schirra. Now, in a moment, we're going over to New Zealand, where Walter Cunningham was 45 years ago. But first, let's tell you who we are.
Greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM 88.3.